Welcome to this week's episode of The Read Out Loud, a weekly biotech podcast from Stat. I'm Damian Garde, socially distancing from the borough of Queens.
I'm Rebecca Robbins, staying home in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And Adam Feuerstein is off today.
It's Thursday, May 14th, and here's what we're going to talk about this week.
First up, our DC colleague Lev Fasher will call in to give us an update on how the COVID-19 response is shaping up in Washington.
Next, Stat contributor Usha Lee McFarling joins us to talk about what the porn industry can teach us about safety in the COVID-19 era.
Finally, we'll switch gears to a non-pandemic topic. Our colleague Sharon Begley will call in to brief us on a story she's been working on for 2 years about a wild idea to treat Parkinson's disease.
But first, a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Angus McCauley, the Chief Revenue Officer of Stat. Throughout the current COVID-19 pandemic, it is crucial to stay connected to the needs of local communities. Life Science Cares is a collective effort of the life sciences industry working to improve the lives of our neighbors impacted by poverty. I'm here with Sarah McDonald, the organization's executive director. Sarah, how can the life sciences community remain socially connected to help the most vulnerable during this global pandemic in what will likely be one of the most difficult times for many?
Life Science Cares is a vehicle for life science companies like Takeda, as well as individual life sciences professionals in Boston and Philadelphia, to help the most vulnerable in their communities. Now, more than ever, it gives us a way to connect and support those whose lives have been upended by COVID-19 through financial contributions, in-kind donations, and virtual volunteering.
Visit lifesciencecares.org to learn more about how Life Science Cares is working to meet the significant and changing needs caused by this unprecedented pandemic and what you can do to help.
An unexpected hotspot, the White House itself.
There is a member of the vice president's team who is positive for coronavirus.
This week brought word that two staffers in the White House had tested positive for COVID-19, news that capped weeks of debate over when it might be safe to send Americans back to work.
And that added to a video conference Senate hearing, the emergence of a pandemic whistleblower, and a controversy over the distribution of a COVID-19 medicine, made this a fractious week in Washington.
Joining us to discuss what's happening in the Capitol is Stat Washington correspondent Lev Fasher. Lev, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the White House. The emergence of coronavirus cases underlines an obvious question. Should Americans feel safe returning to their workplaces if White House employees are in danger at theirs?
Right. I think it's a totally legitimate thing to ask. We've seen now four really high-ranking members of the Trump administration, from the FDA commissioner to the CDC director to Tony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, enter some form of self-quarantine because they recently made contact with someone who tested positive. And if those people are having trouble coming to work and performing the essential functions of government, you know, with all the resources that the White House has and the federal government has at its disposal, it does seem to be a concerning sign for just broader efforts to get millions of Americans back in their workplaces day to day. And then yesterday, actually, Bloomberg reported that the Abbott test that has been widely used across the country, but in particular by the White House, really often misses positive coronavirus cases. So even the testing system being used, hopefully to prevent people with the coronavirus from making direct contact with the president, with the vice president, even that seems a little sketchy lately. So there are some really concerning questions just about kind of the government's basic ability to function in person.
Earlier this week, the Senate Health Committee got a chance to question Trump administration officials on the government's coronavirus response. What did we learn from that hearing?
Well, that was another instance of kind of seeing social distancing bizarrely play out on a public stage. The beginning of the hearing, Lamar Alexander, the Republican committee chairman, he was giving his introductory remarks, and we heard this kind of shuffling and muttering, and all of a sudden there was Bernie Sanders on the screen trying to figure out a pair of headphones sitting in front of a Red Hot Chili Peppers poster in his living room. So we learned that remote hearings are weird. Beyond that, I think we learned that there might be some unrealistic expectations among lawmakers in terms of the timeline for developing therapeutics, but especially developing a vaccine. We saw that when Lamar Alexander asked Tony Fauci, you know, he represents Tennessee in the Senate, and he said, will students at the University of Tennessee be able to return to class in the fall having taken a vaccine that would provide some level of COVID-19 immunity? And Fauci said, absolutely not, which anyone in drug development and who's followed the vaccine development process understands off the bat, but it's just kind of reflective of the immense, immense pressure and the really maybe unrealistic timeline that a lot of folks in Washington have placed on this process. And I think that really shone through. And lastly, Tony Fauci just really, really pushed back on the idea that we should rush to reopen basic functions of the economy before we're ready. And he said in pretty stark terms, doing that is going to lead to further spread of the coronavirus that could lead to more full-blown outbreaks and that could lead to death. And of course, that would force us to return to, in some cases, states of semi-lockdown. And that's the last thing anyone wants right now.
We've talked a lot on this podcast about remdesivir. That's the medicine from Gilead Sciences that appears to offer modest benefits for patients with COVID-19. The federal government is in charge of distributing donated doses of the drug to individual states. Love, how is that process playing out?
Not great, at least at the very beginning. Our colleagues Casey Ross and Eric Budman had a really great story last week about how hospitals across the country were just kind of at a loss in terms of figuring out how to get their hands on this drug, who exactly between AmerisourceBergen, a drug distributor, and the Department of Health and Human Services, the federal player, and Gilead Sciences, the manufacturer itself, were, you know, doling out their limited supply of this drug. Finally, on Saturday, the Trump administration put out a guidance document that listed specific states and particular allocations and did what a lot of public health officials wanted them to do in the first place, which is instead of somewhat randomly giving drugs to particular hospitals, giving drugs to the state public health departments, allowing the state level officials to determine which hospitals were most in need, allowing them to figure out the logistics at a more local level. But there's still a couple unresolved questions. One thing I noticed as I was reading that release was that there didn't seem to be allocations for California, for Florida, and for Pennsylvania. And all of those states are in the top 10 in terms of COVID-19 cases. So one wonders exactly how the allocations were determined even once the Trump administration folks did put out a more defined, comprehensive plan for distributing remdesivir and getting it into the hands of doctors.
So as we record this, Rick Bright, the ousted leader of a federal agency that funds medical research, is testifying before Congress with a litany of criticisms for the federal government's coronavirus response. How has Bright's emergence as a whistleblower resonated in Washington?
You know, one thing that strikes me is that these allegations are really explosive, and my colleague in D.C., Nick Florco, has really done some incredible work detailing the whole process from his ouster at BARDA to the whistleblower complaint. But there's also a way in which it's just kind of faded into the background. Already, we've seen so much movement, so much change in the federal government, and a new initiative they call Warp Speed that focuses on vaccine development that seems to be happening largely outside of BARDA's purview. Of course, Bright's ouster and the testimony he gives today are a huge deal and getting a ton of attention. But given the level of criticism that has been directed at the Trump administration for, you know, many elements within their broader coronavirus response, the Bright ouster and the whistleblower complaint, they feel just kind of, you know, yet another bullet point on a pretty long list. But we're all curious to see how it plays out moving forward.
So as has been pretty well documented at this point, the pandemic has had effects on American healthcare well beyond treating the actual virus itself. Love, you wrote a story this week about how the national shutdown has reshaped the treatment of addiction. How is that playing out?
Something I realized is that in addiction, and I'm sure in other fields of medicine as well, the response to the pandemic actually has kind of forever overturned and streamlined, in this case, the way medicine is practiced. So I spoke to a patient named Nicole in Tennessee, and she kind of counterintuitively had an easier time than she has ever had getting her prescription for buprenorphine, a common opioid addiction drug, refilled. You know, she just delivered twins. She was in the hospital. She wasn't able to drive. And instead of having to make this, you know, long trek to a clinic and deal with paperwork and all these, you know, various steps, this red tape, if you will, she just made a FaceTime appointment with the doctor who refilled a prescription that she filled at a pharmacy around the corner from her house, which, you know, sounds simple, and it is simple. And for that reason, there are a lot of advocates in addiction medicine who are saying, hey, these changes that the federal government has implemented to allow folks to maintain access to care through the pandemic, this is the way it should be always. And I think that there are going to be a lot of interesting conversations, you know, even in a post-pandemic world, hard as that is to imagine, about what we learned in terms of telemedicine and in terms of various prescriber regulations, and just whether there are things that we've done on an emergency basis that actually are going to make sense.
So finally, it can be easy to forget that on top of all of this, we are less than 6 months away from a presidential election. How is the government's coronavirus response shaping the Biden versus Trump conversation?
Nobody is having any rallies. Joe Biden has been doing these kind of semi-frequent press events or fundraisers from the comfort of his basement in, I believe, Delaware. And President Trump, meanwhile, has been on TV constantly. He actually only recently stopped doing daily briefings, which the White House had appeared to view as a political advantage, just having the president on TV kind of every evening. Then, of course, the president made some kind of odd remarks about the potential for injecting disinfectant or bringing ultraviolet light inside the body. And the fallout from that seems to have led the White House to decide that maybe those daily presidential briefings are not a very good idea. But essentially, President Trump, you know, has all of the attention on him. And I think Biden, even though the coronavirus is already the dominant political issue and will be for the next 6 months, has really struggled to get any level of attention because he's out of government right now and is quite literally, you know, hanging out at home like many of the rest of us. The Biden campaign has already run a lot of very critical ads of the Trump administration's response and quoting, you know, various tweets or various statements the president made in January or February where he, you know, downplayed the virus in a way that just proved completely untrue. But, you know, it's hard to envision what things look like for the next several months, but it's certainly going to be the dominant political issue.
Well, Love, thank you as always for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Next up, we're going to talk about a surprising source of guidance on how to be safe in the COVID-19 era. That's the porn industry.
Right, so long before the pandemic, the world of adult film had been testing and tracing its performers for HIV and a host of other sexually transmitted infections.
Joining us to talk about the industry's procedures is Stat contributor Usha Lee McFarling. Usha is a Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist based in Los Angeles.
Usha, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So Usha, take us back to the late 1990s when an outbreak of HIV infections threatened to shutter the porn industry. How did the industry respond?
Yeah, well, I'm really kind of surprised that we're, you know, as we're dealing with this pandemic, that more people aren't talking about, you know, our last pandemic when a terrifying disease was kind of reshaping a lot of things about society. In the late 80s and early 90s, AIDS was really terrifying. And in the porn industry, you know, where people sort of have sex with large numbers of other people for a living, there was a lot of infection occurring on sets and it really wasn't sustainable. And the leaders got together and realized the only way to get people back to work and keep them safe was exactly what people are saying today, you know, test, test, and test some more. And so they implemented a program to do that. And I kind of vaguely knew about that program in the back of my mind. So it really struck me that they might have some important lessons, you know, for the rest of us.
So Usha, can you explain for us how the program that they implemented of testing and tracing works in practice?
Sure. It's definitely evolved since the 90s because HIV tests have evolved and, you know, our understanding of that virus has really grown in these decades since it emerged. What basically happens is that, you know, workers in the, I'd call it the mainstream porn industry, that has, you know, producers and sets and employees and is sort of more above board than some other parts of the industry. If they want to work on a set, they need to report to that set with a clean bill of health. They need to go to a clinic and be tested for a variety of STIs, sexually transmitted infections, including HIV. While a lot of this industry is centered here in Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley, particularly. There's also many sets in Las Vegas, Miami, and interestingly, Montreal. So there's a network of clinics, you know, throughout our country and Canada where people can go and obtain these tests. And if they test negative for any of those infections, their name will have a green check mark in this database that producers and directors can check. If they test positive for an infection, or if they are not tested, if they haven't been tested in the last 14 days, they get a red check mark. That just means they can't work. So this helps protect privacy. A producer or director won't know, oh, that person's infected. They'll only know, oh, they're not cleared to work. And, you know, and it might just be because they happen not to have an up-to-date test. You know, the industry tells me that producers that take this seriously, they enforce it very heavily because they want to keep their workers safe.
And what kind of challenges has the industry encountered in making a program like this work?
That's what really struck me. I mean, they're facing all of the challenges that these task force that are working to put together testing regimes for the coronavirus are facing. Like, how do you ensure the privacy of people, that their medical information is secure and not in a database that could be hacked? How do you prevent forging? Like, how do you keep someone from faking a result so that they can, say, go back to work in a meatpacking plant because they're worried about making ends meet? How do you deal with false positives? Because those come up in the industry. What do you do when you get a positive, like a positive HIV test? What the industry does is they literally shut down all sets until they can do contact tracing before they resume. You know, how do you educate people that they're going to need repeat testing? You know, it's not like you get one negative coronavirus and then you're safe forever. You could get infected, the next week. So there's been a lot of education, a lot of investment into a secure database. You can't just walk in with a paper that can be forged. So they've put a lot of these safeguards into place and spent a lot of time thinking about it.
So on that topic, I know you talked to a lot of public health experts about the lessons that we might take from this program to think about safety as this pandemic stretches on. What were the major takeaways that they had?
First of all, it was a little bit hard to get people to speak with me at first. A lot of people don't want to be associated with the porn industry. So a lot of people turned down requests to be interviewed. But when I did find people, they were really optimistic. You know, they were like, this is a program that works. It's a proof of concept. You know, a lot of groundwork has been laid for, you know, what we need to do. And we can really learn from them. And we shouldn't be so moralistic, like, because we disapprove of this industry, that we can't take lessons from them. So I felt that was very positive. I also felt a lot of public health workers said, you know, there's room for improvement. You know, there are people that worry about this industry, worry about vulnerable people that work in it and feel like, you know, they really should be wearing condoms to protect against STIs, not just testing. They worry about people that float. You know, what if some people just need extra money and they go work on a set that doesn't have testing? And that could be equivalent to, say, a nursing home worker. Maybe they work shifts in a hospital that's really strict and has testing, but then they work weekends at night, you know, at a nursing home that doesn't have testing. So what happens if people go in and out of the testing bubble? How are you going to keep those workplaces safe? And who will pay for these kind of programs? In the porn industry, actors pay themselves. They pay about $150 for each test. You know, well, especially low-wage frontline workers, is it fair to put that burden on them when this is a public health matter, or is the government going to have to pay? You know, so while they said there's great lessons to be learned, there's also still a lot we need to think through.
Usha, one thing that really stood out to me in your story was how seriously you took this industry as a source of public health lessons. You know, this community, after all, doesn't often get that kind of treatment in the press. So how did you think about approaching the tone of this story?
Well, thank you. You know, when I first came up with this as an idea and was investigating whether or not it was a story, I really committed to myself, I'm not going to do this unless it's a serious story and there's some public health lessons to be learned. But as I spoke to more and more people, I was convinced they were. And as I spoke to people in the porn industry, including performers, you know, they struck me as very serious. They kept talking about how they make their decisions based on science. They take their sexual health very seriously because it's their livelihood. They're very smart about it. They're very proactive. And they're really proud of what they've done in their own industry. And they do feel they can, like, help teach others. So I think they were really kind of honored to be included in a story about this. And I felt like they had a lot to say.
Usha, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, guys.
This week, the world learned about an audacious new attempt to treat Parkinson's disease, one that involves surgically implanting lab-grown brain cells into patients' skulls in hopes of restoring normal function.
That work was carried out in secret over a number of years, and it was first reported by Stat's Sharon Bagley. Sharon described the unprecedented process as something like The Amazing Race meets ER. And since it came to light, it has fascinated other scientists and alarmed some ethicists.
Sharon joins us now to discuss how she got behind the curtain on the research, how the procedure actually works, and what it means for the future of Parkinson's treatment. Sharon, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Damien.
So Sharon, before we get into the details of the novel surgery, tell us, how did you first get word that this was in progress?
The researchers reached out to me soon after they did the two transplants. Those were conducted in September of 2017, March of 2018, and a few months later, they said, you know, we've done this thing. Might you be interested? And, you know, to cut to the chase, they then got cold feet about going public with what they had done. So that's why the story came out only this week.
So how does this approach to treating Parkinson's actually work in practice?
So the general idea has been around since the 1980s, actually. And that's because what goes wrong in Parkinson's disease is pretty straightforward. You know, simply there's a loss of dopamine producing neurons. So you look at that and say, well, the fix is obviously to put in new dopamine producing neurons. And in fact, that was done in the late 1980s using neurons from the brains of aborted fetuses. And as you can imagine, there were all sorts of ethical concerns about that. So that has not gone forward. And instead, with the advent of stem cell science, researchers looked around at what those could do and said, you know what? We can take stem cells, cause them to differentiate into dopamine-producing neurons, and put them into the brains of Parkinson's patients, and that should be a fix. So that's been a hope for a number of years, but for all sorts of technical difficulties and other reasons, this is the first time that it was actually done in a patient.
So as you've written the story, the way this all came about was a real far cry from the familiar scientific process of getting grants and partnering with pharmaceutical companies. Tell us about George Lopez.
He is a physician in California. He is the founder of a medical device company. And almost 10 years ago, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And he was getting worse and worse. And one day decided, you know what? I'm not just going to take this. I'm going to go out and actively see if somebody can come up with a cure. So through going to scientific meetings and talking to his neurologist, et cetera, he connected with a basic molecular biologist here in the Boston area, reached out to him and said, what would it take for your research to go twice as fast as it now is? And this researcher, whose name is Dr. Kim, said $2 million would do it. And so George Lopez wrote a check to Kim's institution, McLean Hospital, and they were off to the races.
So fast forwarding, that all led to the day in 2017 when this went from a promising idea to an actual surgery with Lopez as the patient. How did the procedure play out?
So they had to create, invent, develop whole new medical devices, needles, syringes, cannulas, etc., to do this. But having done it, the first transplant was done at Weill Cornell Hospital in Manhattan. The basic idea was you drill holes in the skull in a couple of places. You try really hard to avoid the areas of cortex that George Lopez would need to live the rest of his life. And you inject these dopamine-producing neurons, again, those had been created from stem cells, into the region of the brain where they could connect to the motor regions. Because, of course, in Parkinson's disease, the most obvious and debilitating symptoms are the loss of control over motor function. So they did that. And within a few hours after George Lopez woke up from the surgery, he felt like a new person. He walked to Times Square. He said he had gotten his life back, etc. Well, that was clearly not going to be a permanent condition for, you know, a bunch of interesting reasons having to do with what the injected cells do initially. He probably got a huge infusion of dopamine, which helped him, but that did not last. Anyway, so they did a second transplant 6 months later, and now we're more than 2 years after that. And Lopez is doing okay. He is probably better than he would have been without the transplants. Everybody is quick to say this is not a cure, but you know what? He's able to go spearfishing again. He can swim, something he had stopped because he was afraid he would drown. He had not even been able to tie his shoelaces starting a couple of years ago. So, you know, he seems to be better. You always have to be careful when you have a single patient, obviously. But, you know, bottom line, it seems to have been safe. So the researchers are trying to conduct a real clinical trial with a small number of patients, but certainly more than one.
So this story became public just a few days ago with your piece in Stat and a paper from the researchers in the New England Journal of Medicine. What has been the reaction to the news?
It's been, wow, how did they do this in secret? for the most part. And then there was the second wow. Really? You did this history-making experiment basically with the money from the person who would become the patient. So a lot of ethical concerns there, including about whether there was truly informed consent or whether the fact that the patient had sunk $2 million into this might have clouded his judgment about whether he should be the first patient. Everybody says that when the $2 million check was written, George Lopez did not intend, he did not make it conditional on his being the first patient. But, you know, this is something that's going to be discussed in the medical ethics textbooks for a long time.
So what are you looking out for next in this saga?
Whether the researchers get the go-ahead and the funding, the go-ahead from the FDA and funding from wherever they can, you know, get it to launch a true clinical trial. They're talking about maybe a dozen patients. It would be at a single site, probably in Boston. The neurosurgeon is at Massachusetts General Hospital. And the reason they would not do a multi-center study is that the actual transplant surgery is tricky. It's, you know, it's brain surgery. So they don't want to face the hurdle of training a lot of other neurosurgeons on this. They want to keep it sort of in-house, as it were, in hopes of having the best possible outcome.
Well, Sharon, keep us posted on what happens next. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.
That does it for another episode of The Read Out Loud.
Thank you to Hyacinth Empanado, who produced this week's episode.
Alyssa Ambrose is our senior producer, and Rick Burke is our executive producer.
And we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you like about this week's episode, what you didn't like, which other industries might be instructive when it comes to dealing with a pandemic. You can do all of that by sending us an email at readoutloud@statnews.com.
And if you like what we do, please consider leaving us a review or a rating on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to get your podcasts.
See you next week.